listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net, where you will discover numerous resources. I'm very grateful for the gentleman that created and manages that site. That same individual also created the website, screeningsandyhook.net. I hope that you will also take the time to visit and read the many articles found at that website. My regular website is spingola.com, where you will find numerous articles and where you may review past programs. Just visit spingola.com and click on the radio schedule button on the left side of the page to see past and future guests. If you wish to ask questions or make comments during the program, during the broadcast, please email comment@spingola.email, and I welcome the listeners to visit the chat room, which is at spingola.chatango.com. My guest today for the first 2 hours is James Perloff. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline, which was published in 1988, and which I read back then. He also published 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, Solving Political, Cultural, and Spiritual Riddles, Past and Present. And he's currently working on another book. No surprise there for a prolific writer. His website is jamesperloff.com. And back on July 4th, James reposted his well-researched, well-sourced article, Who Wrote the Declaration of Independence? And that is the subject of today's program. And it's always relevant. And I think that it's really relevant. Welcome, James.
Hi, Deanna. Thanks for having me back on. It's great to be with you. Certainly one of the most informed radio hosts out there and someone who's not reluctant to tackle tough issues.
Nor are you. And this is tough, especially for some people within the so-called alternative media, because many people have placed a lot of their hopes and their claims and what they believe to be to be their rights into a document that really has very auspicious beginnings and whose writers were really creators who were really all about themselves, and they had well, I'll let you explain who they were. And certainly we do need to ask some questions. We can't just accept things for how they seem to be. But you do have to look into the background, which is what you have done.
Yeah, I think we probably should acknowledge at the outset that there are many great Americans who have the greatest admiration of the Founding Fathers and, you know, spoken for many patriotic groups that pretty fit into that class. So include the John Birch Society, Oath Keepers, Campaign for Liberty, etc. And I appreciate these are some of our best citizens. They're against immorality, abortion, gay marriage, transgenderism. They believe in the Bill of Rights. And so when you bring this up, sometimes it can create cognitive dissonance. And I was in this class myself, by the way, of thinking before I started to realize that America, its revolution, like most world revolutions, is really Freemasonic. It's sold to us as a Christian event. But actually, if you look at rebellion, whether it's a child rebellion at home or Satan's rebellion in heaven or the Bolshevik revolution. Usually, revolution is not consistent with God's character. In fact, you know, you'll often hear pastors preach on the obedience of authority, quoting Romans 13, right? So we're going to look a little bit, but specifically on the Declaration of Independence today, which is a subject that you want to do a show around. And when we say who wrote it, of course, many people will react, well, of course, everybody knows who wrote it. It was Thomas Jefferson, case closed, right? But the truth is that in early America, nobody knew who wrote the Declaration, and that was basically a state secret for 45 years. And what we're going to be looking at today is there was Thomas Paine, not Thomas Jefferson, who wrote it. Jefferson did not even take any credit for it until 45 years after the fact when he was an old man. And we'll look at the reasons why Thomas Paine could not be acknowledged. But, you know, interesting, Deanna, you and I did a show before, not a very popular one. It was on the Battle of Lexington. You know, I grew up in Lexington, Mass, where the shot around the world was fired, and we won't get into that in any depth, but it seems that early America had some kind of 50-year oath of secrecy, and if you look at the Boston Tea Party, nobody knew the men who took part of it. The names were not revealed because all the people who took part in the Boston Tea Party took a 50-year oath of silence, and that's why it wasn't until 1834 when a member of the Boston Tea Party, George Hughes, who wrote a book called Retrospect of the Boston Tea Party, it was published in 1834. And Lexington, you know, it wasn't until on the cusp of the 50th anniversary of the American Revolution, 1825, that the truth became known that shots had been fired at the colonists at Lexington. And the reason that happened really was because the neighboring town of Concord was claiming that on the 50th anniversary, they were going to take credit for the first forcible resistance against the British. This sparked an outrage in my hometown, Lexington. And they got new depositions together, which stated the colonists had indeed fired on the British. And so that 50-year secret was revealed. And isn't it interesting that two of the men on the drafting committee of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, died exactly on the date that a 50-year oath would have expired. They both died on July the 4th, 1826. I always kind of thought that was kind of a romantic thing.
That,
you know,
is
it probably is. I'm sure it's basically just a coincidence.
But that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, pretty amazing. But there appears to be this 50-year oath of secrecy. But let's get into the evidence that Thomas Paine wrote it, not Thomas Jefferson, and then we'll go into why Thomas Paine could not be acknowledged.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I remember when we did that that initial program and some of the response that you got. But let's talk about this today.
Okay.
It was interesting.
Okay. So, another disclaimer I want to make is that, you know, in vetting this, we're not suggesting that America should return to British rule. I get that question pretty often. I'm not suggesting. In fact, we've been in an Anglo-American establishment, as Carol Quigley put it, an alliance with the British, going back, well over a century. And, you know, I'm certainly critical of that. And I'm not against just wars. I'm not against rebelling when it's necessary against, an evil government. But to get on to Paine, I want to mention that I'm not the first person who's made this case, that's for sure. This goes way back to the 18th century. For example, you had a book published in 1872. It's called Junius Unmasked, or Thomas Paine, the author of the Letters of Junius and the Declaration of Independence, by Joel Moody. Walter Williams wrote about it in 1906. In 1947, Joseph Lewis published a book called Thomas Paine, Author of the Declaration of Independence. So this discussion, this controversy has been going on for some time, even if it's not really in mainstream education systems. As far as Jefferson's claim, again, he made this in 1821, Here's what he said specifically. He said, quote, talking about the committee to draft the declaration, he said, quote, the committee were Jay Adams, Dr. Franklin, Roger Sherman, Robert R. Livingston, and myself. Committees were also appointed at the same time to prepare a plan of confederation for the colonies. The committee for drawing the Declaration of Independence desired me to do it. It was accordingly done, and being approved by them, I reported to the House on Friday the 28th of June when it was read in order to lie on the table. End quote. So saying it was accordingly done is not a very emphatic claim to authorship. And there is a copy, a rough draft of the Declaration in Jefferson's hand, but you find it also in John Adams' hand. And what we're finding is that Adams and Jefferson had made copies of Paine's original. So let's get to the reasons why we're with virtual certainty can say it was Thomas Paine. If you look at the original rough draft of the Declaration, it had a passionate clause against slavery, which was stricken out. And let me read that clause. Referring to King George's III, that clause of the Declaration of Independence, rough draft said, quote, he has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty, the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, Christians capitalized, determined to keep a market where men is capitalized, should be bought and sold. Okay, now, it's very unlikely that Thomas Jefferson would have written this into the rough draft of the Declaration because he was a slave owner, he owned over 600 slaves, and he'd never written even a mild denunciation of slavery. But Thomas Paine, on the other hand, who came here in 1774, he'd been living in England prior to then, published an essay here in America in 1775 called African Slavery in America. In his way, he wrote, quote, that some desperate wretches should be willing to steal enslaved men by violence and murder for gain is rather lamentable, but that many, nay, Christianized people should approve and be concerned of this, the savage practice is surprising. Are traders in men, which he capitalizes, an unnatural commodity, must know the wickedness of the slave trade. Okay, so, here we've got, the rough draft of the Declaration, you know, passionately condemning slavery, something that Thomas Jefferson didn't come close to doing, but that Paine did. And both documents capitalized the word men. And this is one of our first giveaways, that it's the hand of Paine and not the hand of Jefferson.
Ah.
Well, moving on, Declaration shows great contempt for King George III. And here's what it says in the Declaration of Independence. It says, quote, the history of the present King of Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. End quote. Now, that is very characteristic of Paine. You know, he came here in 1774, I was mentioning, and he wrote a pamphlet called Common Sense, which was really the main document that advocated American independence. It sold tens of thousands of copies, right away. And, let me just mention, Deanna, you're an author, and you know that to get huge circulation, usually you gotta have a little help, especially if you're brand new to the country. And I would just suggest that since Thomas Paine was sent to England by Benjamin Franklin, who was Grand Master of the Freemasonic Lodges of Pennsylvania, came over here with a letter of introduction from Franklin, there was a hidden hand, and I would suggest probably the Freemasons who were helping to up that circulation, you know, in other words, people who obeying their oaths of allegiance and obedience were making sure that that was circulated. But if you look at Common Sense, which he advocated the very thing that the Declaration was advocating, which was independence from Great Britain, here's his attitude towards King George III in Common Sense. He calls him the royal brute of Great Britain. He says, quote, I rejected the hard and sullen tempered Pharaoh of England forever and disdain the wretch that with a pretended title of father of his people can unfeelingly hear of their slaughter, and composedly sleep with their blood upon his soul. The naked and untutored Indian is less savage than the King of Britain. That's Thomas Paine. All right, now compare that to Thomas Jefferson, who, by the way, had never written a tract or a paper calling for American independence from Great Britain. Here's how he referred to the king in a summary view of the rights of British America. He said, quote, to propose to said Congress that an humble and dutiful address be presented to His Majesty, begging leave to lay before him as Chief Magistrate of the British Empire the united complaints of His Majesty's subjects in America, which would persuade His Majesty through asking favors and not rights, shall obtain from His Majesty a respectful acceptance. And so he continued first to the king as His Majesty. He never refers to him as a wretch or tyrant or things right. of that nature. All right. Another one, which is, I think, actually critical, it's just a style issue. The Declaration uses the word hath. All experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, right? But if you look at Thomas Jefferson's writings, and it's been estimated he has something like 3 million words in print, he never once used the word hath, which is an archaic version of the word has.
Oh, right. Hath. H-A-T-H. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. On the other hand, Thomas Paine used it all the time. In Common Sense, he used the word hath 87 times.
Whoa.
That's a stylistic clue that it is Paine writing the Declaration and not Jefferson. And here's another one. The rough draft condemned the king for using Scotch and foreign mercenaries. Now, the delegates at the Continental Congress struck out Scotch and. They didn't want to offend Scotsmen. Well, let's look at this. Would Thomas Jefferson have written such a thing? Thomas Jefferson actually traced part of his ancestry to Scotland. And when he was a student, he had Scottish teachers. And he was very friendly towards Scotsmen. But if you look at the writings of Thomas Paine in Britain, he displayed bitter disdain towards Scotsmen. So again, you can see this coming from the hand of Paine. And you these are just examples, but you can find broad examples in the books I mentioned at the top of the show. And there are other things. You know, you can find parts of the Declaration that correlate with parts of Common Sense. You notice that it would not be surprising for Benjamin Franklin to assign Thomas Paine to write a Declaration of Independence, since he also assigned them to write Common Sense, which was the main document calling for independence. He was in Philadelphia at the time. And so read these books, and you can check my article online. It's called The American Revolution, Part 2, Who Wrote the Declaration of Independence. And you'll find that there is considerable documentary evidence, which, again, has been made for a century and a half at least, that it was Thomas Paine and not Jefferson.
Indeed. And these are stylistic things that you have pointed out, which requires critical reading. But they certainly do make sense, because everybody has a writing style that if you're a careful reader, you're going to pick up on that style, which you obviously have, and which I'm very grateful that you've pointed these things out.
Right, and if you look at the style, you look at Thomas Jefferson, he would write very long run-on sentences.
Right.
Whereas Thomas Paine would write bullet point, which I think is a good way to write, actually. And that's the way the Declaration is written. Like, he's got a list of 27 grievances, bullet points, you know, one after the other.
Right.
It's not the way that Thomas Jefferson would write. And I think the evidence is pretty convincing that it was Paine who wrote this. We should also get into the reasons why it couldn't be acknowledged.
Yes.
There were three basic reasons that I can see, and one is that people would assume that the Declaration of Independence was written by their elected delegates. Thomas Paine was not an elected delegate. He was not an official member of the Continental Congress, and so it should not have been assigned to someone outside that Congress. But that is one reason, so that, you know, voters would not feel betrayed. A second reason, a little more significant, is the fact that Thomas Paine was not actually an American. And I think this would have created a lot of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
People know that the Declaration of Independence was written by an Englishman. He actually came over here November the 30th, 1774, with a letter of introduction from Ben Franklin. Now, Franklin had met Paine in England, where Paine was an author of anonymous pamphlets, and it's quite apparent that Franklin saw the talents that this man presented as a writer and sent him over for these specific purposes. Now, actually, there was a law in America at that time. You know, he came over on November 30, 1774. That's less than 6 months before the Battle of Lexington, which started the war going. So he hadn't been here very long. not by, you know, I believe it was a Pennsylvania man, an official sentence, a citizen, excuse me. We'll get to that at the other side of the break.
Okay. Right. Alrighty, we will be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty, we are back. I guess the first 2 hours today is James Perloff, and we're talking about who really wrote a document that we're all familiar with, and where we're talking about writing styles. And when you were talking, I was thinking about Thomas Wolfe, who was very, very famous for his very, very long sentences. Well, at least I thought of Thomas Wolfe when you were talking about stylistic writing. And anyway, so please pick up where we left off.
Yes, Dina, we were talking about the reasons why Thomas Paine cannot be acknowledged
right.
as the author. And we mentioned he was not an elected official. He was not an elected delegate to the Continental Congress. And by the standards of the day, he was neither an American. I should mention that before the Constitution was even enacted, he returned to his native Britain, and he stayed in Europe from 1787 till 1802.
Wow.
So this was, you know, he came, he saw, he did, and he left.
Right.
You know,
yes.
He went back to Britain. He wrote a book called The Rights of Man, which was designed to inspire the British people to overthrow King George III. They didn't like it. He left, and he went to France, and he became a French citizen. And he became a member of their National Assembly. This is very ironic, by the way, because during the American Revolution, Thomas Paine, 1781, had been part of an American delegation. You know, the colonists, of course, were, during the war, were hurting for money. He went over there, and he was part of the team that persuaded the King of France to provide them with
right.
a huge sum of silver money, which he gave them. Support the war. But then you see that subsequent to America being established, he now goes to France and then is part of the revolution that overthrows the very line of monarchs that had supported the American Revolution. So as you can see, Thomas Paine, this is not a patriotic thing for him. It's not an American thing for him. He was basically a gun for hire wherever
right.
revolution and the overthrow of monarchies would call for. He did eventually return to America and died here. But he was not, you know, again, he was a French citizen, he was a British citizen, and he was an American. So this is not a guy who was intrinsically American. And again, this would surprise people that he'd only been here a very short time before writing the Declaration, because you would think it was someone who had spent a lifetime here suffering, you know, grievances at the hands of the British. But that was not the case for him. But there was an even more significant reason why he could not be acknowledged. I think this is really the most important one. He later wrote a book called The Age of Reason, and he came out violently against Christianity. And let's take some quotes from that book. Quote, "It is the fable of Jesus Christ as told in the New Testament and the wild and visionary doctrine raised thereon against which I contend. Of all the systems of religion that were ever invented, there is none more derogatory to the Almighty, more unedifying to man, more repugnant to reason, and more contradictory in itself than this thing called Christianity. I have shown in all the foregoing parts of this work that the Bible and Testament are impositions and forgeries. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, by the Roman Church, by the Greek Church, by the Turkish Church, or by the Protestant Church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church." So you see, Deanna, there he's establishing himself as a rationalist of the day. Very anti-Christian, very anti-Bible, very anti-God. And this is ironic because, you know, you go into evangelical churches, they regard the founding fathers as churches, as Christians. This is what they've been taught by men like David Barton.
Oh,
but
yes.
This
David
ties
Barton.
In, by the way, to the neocon wars, because this
right.
convinces people that wars are Christian things. These were Christians who fought these wars, not Freemasons. And, At the end of that article, I've got a clip of David Barton where he's talking about if you go against Israel, you're going against God. I'm just paraphrasing there. But he's a very strong Zionist, as well as a man who spent much of his life persuading people here in America that the Founding Fathers were Christians and the American Revolution was a Christian event. Now, I know this is a pretty short segment, but I wanted to mention that just an example of this. I was in, used to go to evangelical churches and the, I'm Orthodox now, but the pastor on the 4th of July was saying quite a few things that I knew not to be true about America. And one of the things he did was he quoted the Declaration of Independence to convince the congregation that the Founding Fathers were Christians, you know, Bible-believing evangelical Christians. And there are a couple of phrases in there which would, at first glance, seem to support that. And here's what Thomas Paine wrote. Looks like, are we about to bump out again?
Just momentarily.
Okay.
So maybe we should save
maybe
that.
Maybe we should hold on this until maybe Dan, you've got some things to say about this. I know I've been kind of dominating the conversation.
It's just really amazing to me how many churches are so in favor of warfare and killing other people who have not done a thing to them, of destroying other people's infrastructure. It just makes me very upset. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty, we are back.
It starts with you and me.
And our guest, the first 2 hours today is James Perloff, and we were talking about churches who encourage warfare. I have a very good friend, Reagan, who was talking to a local, church leader, and, she said, there is a special place in hell, for people like you. And I tend to agree with her, and just by chance, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says, rich people start wars, poor people die in them, and their children pay for them. So I'm definitely anti-war. The church that I used to belong to was very pro-war, and I decided I really didn't want to belong to that church because I just warfare is wrong, period, plain and simple.
Absolutely, Dan. In fact, I just want to give a quote here from Smedley Butler, who, as you know, was the most decorated Marine in the history of the U.S. Marine Corps when he died in 1940.
Right.
Major General, fought in many wars.
My grandfather was his aide.
That's right. That's right. I forgot that. Why don't you give the audience his name again?
Oh, my grandfather? Arthur, yes. J. Burks, B-R-K-S.
Yeah, after you told me that on a previous show, and I looked him up afterwards. Pretty amazing, but here's what Smedley Butler said in War is a Racket. Quote, in the World War, talking about World War I, of course, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, 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 to kill the Germans. God is on our side. End quote. And, you know, Dana, that reminds me so much of some of the churches that I sat in before, where war would be glorified. We would be told that the wars, the current Middle East wars, were to defend our liberties, which is, you know, by the same phrase that was used during the American Revolution. You know, just, I don't know, something about, it's like a Manchurian candidate trigger phrase. You bring up freedom and say freedom, and people just think that everything's justified now. But this particular sermon I'm recalling before that I had to walk out on, was the pastor was quoting the Declaration of Independence, and here's what he was quoting. He's laying emphasis on certain words. When in the course of human events becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them, "A Decent Respect to the Opinions of Mankind Requires That They Should Declare the Causes Which Impel Them to Separation. Behold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Now, people were ooh and aahing in the congregation of saying this, but I knew that Thomas Paine had written this. He was not an evangelical Christian, and that's where, you know, these people were accepting at this point, was that this was written by an evangelical Christian. But let me just give you some other quotes from Thomas Paine that show what he really meant by nature's God and creator. He said in another one of his treatises on religion, quote, "But when I see throughout the greatest parts of this book," meaning the Bible, "scarcely anything but a history of the grossest vices and a collection of the most paltry and contemptible tales, I cannot dishonor my creator by calling it by his name." And as far as the phrase nature's God goes, which also appears in the Declaration of Independence, Paine wrote this in The Age of Reason, quote, "When therefore we look through nature up to nature's God, we are on the right road of happiness, but when we trust to books," meaning the Bible, "as the word of God and confide in them as revealed religion, we are afloat in an ocean of uncertainty and shattering contending factions," end quote. Thomas Paine is very clear when he said nature's God and creator. He was not referring to the God of the Bible, and he was not at the least bit an evangelical Christian, but that's what people have been convinced of over the years. Believing, of course, this is actually written by Thomas Jefferson. But I should probably mention that even if Thomas Jefferson had written the Declaration, even if he had, he himself, as you probably know, wrote a what they call the Jefferson Bible. I shouldn't say he wrote it. What he did was he took a razor blade and he cut out everything out of the New Testament that he didn't like, anything that referred to Jesus being the Son of God, the divinity of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus, the resurrection, and just basically left you with a few wise sayings. Now, for some reason, he gets a free pass on this. But, you know, if you or I did that in an evangelical church, how soon would we be showing the door? And they would quote to us Revelation 22:19, which says, "And if any man shall take away from the words of this book, or this prophecy, God shall take away his part of the book of life and out of the holy city and from the things that are written in this book." So, this is what I call free pass theology, where there's one standard for Christians today and another standard for the founding fathers. Unfortunately, you have to go back and ask, if they're such great Christians, why then didn't they do what Jesus said and render unto Caesar what was Caesar's? But Thomas Paine clearly could not be acknowledged as the writer of this document, because in addition to, again, being unelected and not being an American, he was extremely violently anti-Christian, and this would have created, again, cognitive dissonance among early Americans that they knew. And that, so again, it wasn't until 1821, 45 years later, than the elderly Jefferson finally took credit for having written it. But it was a state secret up until that point. It still is, I guess you could say.
Right, right. And of course, the Bible is a compilation of books that were arbitrarily put together, and the comment at the end of Revelations could have referred to just the book of Revelation, or you know, some people say, well, the entire book. It's just amazing that people have not looked at this as you have done in depth. But it's because we tend to all accept what our leaders tell us, and we've been programmed to accept authority figures, and that's unfortunate, because people learn from their church leaders, or they learn from government schools, and that's what we remember, and that's what we're programmed to believe. And when you go to church, you don't expect that they're going to be encouraging warfare. It just seems absurd that these people that are supposed to be saying love your neighbor as yourself and all this other, that they would think it was okay to go and kill a bunch of strangers.
Yeah, what I see is a melding together, and this is not certainly not true of all churches, but in a number of churches that I experienced, this melding together of Uncle Sam with the image of God, and that, you know, the patriotism and going hand in hand with Christianity. Of course, I regard patriotism as a virtue. You know, I see nothing wrong with being loyal to your country, just like you'd be loyal to your family.
Sure.
But not beyond the bounds of righteousness and truthfulness, you know. And I certainly believe in such a thing as a just war. I mean, if there's a, you know, Attila the Hun's brought his troops up to your border, then you better get ready to defend yourself. It's like defending your home. You know, you should be prepared to defend your home, but you only want to pull that gun out as an absolute last resort. You don't pull out a gun and shoot someone because you don't agree with what he's saying. Unfortunately, most of our wars in America have been based, as you know, on false pretexts, whether it's incubators for the 1991 Gulf War,
right,
non-existent weapons of mass destruction for the invasion of Iraq, bombing Libya and turning it into, you know, a cesspool after it was actually the most prosperous nation in the whole MENA, you know, Middle East, Northeastern region with an average per capita income of 15,000 each, dropping cruise missiles on Syria, which is, you know, one of the last strongholds of Christianity in the Middle East, you know, and the Christians and Muslims there are united against, the white helmets and El Nusra Front and, Al Qaeda, with these terrorists who have been trying to destroy their country and take it away from Assad, who's beloved by his people, you know. He's
right.
Beloved. You know, I did an interview with a Syrian Christian who's an MD, you know, a doctor here in America on my website, and that actually had more Facebook shares in its first, I think 6,000 in its first week than any of the posts I've put out. But, the people in Syria love Assad, not everybody, you know, that, as she pointed out to me, you know, no leader, looking at it as any American president ever had 100% support from his people? No, but he's beloved by most people, and he's very good to the Christians there, and there's plenty of footage of him being greeted at monasteries and at churches. They have, it's a secular state, and it's one of the last ones there that has been taken over by extreme Islamic fundamentalism, which, as you know, is backed by the Zionists, who want to fragmentize and turn these once strong nations into backwards nations, you know, ruled by ISIS.
And right. So-called. Right.
The greater Israel that they're after.
And you brought up, neighbors. It is amazing that the government can do, what you yourself can't personally do. For instance, she said you can't go over and shoot your neighbor just because you don't believe in the same doctrines that he believes in, just as you cannot go and perform an abortion on your neighbor, but the government passes laws or engages in activities that it is illegal for an individual to engage in. And that's a very questionable thing. You have to wonder, well, who the heck is running the government and who's running the government? Who is funding all of these Congress critters?
That goes right to the heart of the matter, and it's certainly not the American people. It's not of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now we look at the executive branch, or really the Congress. We know that unfortunately AIPAC and has got a stranglehold on our Congress, and we're seeing America the incredible decline over the last few years, you know, transgenderism suddenly being normalized. You know, that's something that just 15 years ago, nobody would even thought that was thinkable. I'm amazed at how quickly they normalized it amongst the broad population. And I was told by a red pill doctor recently, she's seen the horrors of transgenderism, you know, the young girls with their breasts cut off, you know, double mastectomies because they think they want to be a boy, and their ovaries cut out, and their uteruses of this transgender policy. And she says that the next thing down the pike is going to be open pedophilia, and because what they're going to do is they're going to say that if a child can decide they want to be a boy instead of a girl, or a girl instead of a boy, then they can choose to have sex with adults. And of course, it's really the adults that are calling the shots there. But the first thing was gay marriage, the second was transgenderism, the next thing will be open sexual relations. And you wonder how long God's going to stand by and tolerate that. the degradation in this country is extreme, which is not to in any way deny that there's a great many millions of good people out there who continue to cling to their traditional values that go back to what I would call the golden age of America, leave it to beaver age, when we were, you know, united and we had common values and nobody would have ever contemplated any of these grotesque Luciferian things that happen in America today.
And keep in mind, you've used the television as, or people use TV and movies and the media to promote, and you have to figure out, well, who's behind the media, all the media, and who promote the stuff and give the general population the idea that this is widely accepted simply because it's thrown in their face day after day after day after day, and children are so impressionable. And so what are they being taught in schools, for Pete's sake? There's reading, writing, arithmetic? No, they're being taught what? You must question it and ask yourself, well, do you really want to send your child to a public school?
Yeah, it's the choice is clear, and you know, for people who can do it, they should really be either homeschooling their children or sending them to a good Christian school, because the public schools are agenda driven for the most part. Not to say there aren't some really good public school teachers out there who themselves are Christians and are trying to, you know, keep the system as sane as they can for as long as they can. Yeah, but unfortunately, we're also looking at the Freemasoning of America as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, and again, this goes back to the almost all revolutions being undertaken by Freemasons. As you know, our tribal friends don't have enough bodies to overthrow a king, so they always had to bring, you know, the Goy secret societies in. Because they had the numbers to do it, and as you know, belong to society with a skull and bones or upper ranks Freemasonry, you're offered things in return for, you know, doing things that are abominable. But if you go back, you know, I trace it, the real turning point for America in the last century was 1963. I remember it so vividly, being a teenager back then, when the television content changed. And summer of 63 was when the according to Father Malachi Martin, the Vatican enthroned Lucifer. I don't know if that's true or not, but he said during that summer they enthroned Lucifer. But at the same time, in America, the Supreme Court was very busy kicking God out of schools. And, you know, they ruled that you could no longer pray in public schools and you could no longer read the Bible in public schools. Summer of 63, was in the second of those, two rulings. And, do you know that 5 out of 9 Supreme Court justices were Freemasons at that time? I'll give their names: Hugo Black, William Douglas, Tom Clark, Potter Stewart, and the Chief Justice Earl Warren. So they had a guarantee. And the way I look at this, Deanna, what I've realized over the years is that, the Freemasons who sit in the Supreme Court regard their loyalty to their oath loyalty to the Brotherhood to completely outweigh their oath to the Constitution. And that's why, you know, conservatives scratch their heads and say, well, why are these guys doing these anti-religious, anti-Christian things? It's because these guys are loyal to another entity, which is not Christian. And it's not that they don't understand the Constitution. They understand it very well. How could prayer in schools be constitutional for almost 2 centuries and then all of a sudden they discover that it's unconstitutional? It doesn't even begin to make sense. But when they did that, I distinctly remember, I grew up in Lexington, Mass, and I saw my classmates change in the fall of 63. I saw them go from good kids who I'd grown up with to these little demon-like characters, and I was so upset by it that when my mother came in to tell me about President Kennedy's assassination, I couldn't even focus because I was so upset by the changes in my classmates. I mean, things were really stirred up at that time. And of course, Kennedy's assassination went along with that. And then, of course, in 64, what do you get? You get the Beatles, who become the centerpiece of the Cultural Revolution, and you get Tonkin Gulf, which starts the war going, and the entire culture shifts from what I call a Leave It to Beaver culture to a Woodstock culture.
It's happened.
63 to 69, it just took 6 years.
We have a commercial. We'll be right back. back. This is Deanna, and our guest is James Perloff, and we were talking about the change in the culture, and you were talking about Supreme Court justices, and they are supposed to be not making up new laws. They are supposed to be enforcing or defining the law as it was given, and not making up new things, which of course they've been doing for quite a long time, according to an agenda that we are, that is totally against what so many people believe in. And we're talking about schoolrooms, and I remember also that there's a big difference in the way that a classroom appears to be. When I was in grammar school, you had to raise your hand, you were quiet, you didn't chew gum, it was just very orderly and quiet, so that children could have an opportunity to learn and to listen to the teacher. And now going into a classroom, gosh, there's paper airplanes being thrown, people texting on their phones. They're just chaotic. And then of course, we have the laws in 1965 were altered, about taxes with churches. The immigration law was changed drastically. Then you had abortion, which totally, it just made human life almost irrelevant. It with 58 million slaughtered children later, it's just incredible.
Yeah, they've got a whole culture of death, and right. You know, whether we're talking about the old days with eugenics and the war, right. The war is of course still continuing, but abortion was part of that, you know, killing the most innocent. And actually, there's so many quotes from the elites on population control. You know, Prince Philip and Ted Turner and Robert McNamara have all talked about, of course, Bill Gates, you know, talking about the greatest priority is to reduce world population. And so you see things like gay marriage and transgenderism, sex robots, you know, all these things, taking the uterus out of a woman, a young teenager who thinks she wants to be a boy. That's one of the ways they're reducing the population, because these people can't have children, you know, two homosexuals
right.
To reproduce. Transgenders are not good candidates to reproduce at all. So it's part of the program. There's really a very sinister side to it.
Absolutely. It's tragic when you really look at history or recent, very recent history, how it has changed. And yet people accept these changes so easily, or at least we're led to believe that they accept them easily.
Yeah, and I agree with you, you know, about the old days. You know, when I went to second grade, La Cañada, California in 1958, our teacher would read from the Bible at the start of every class. And I sure miss that type of America. That was really the golden age, you know, when you had morality in the schools as a matter of course. And but of course, that Bible reading had to stop with that Supreme Court decision of 63.
Right. All righty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Stay with us. Be right back.
Network.
back. This is Deanna, and our guest the first 2 hours today is James Perloff. He is an author. Some of his works, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline, and 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, Solving Political, Cultural, and Spiritual Riddles, Past and Present. And you're currently working on another book. Jim's website is jamesperloff.com. So, and we're talking about the his article, which was reposted on July 4th, Who Wrote the Declaration of Independence? And it's very interesting that we think of the Declaration of Independence as a founding document, but gosh, when you look at who wrote it and why it was written, and somebody in the chat room said Thomas Paine, of course, was a hired gun. In other words, a pamphleteer and a professional rabble rouser, which makes a lot of sense. And anyway.
Well, Deanna, one thing that's becoming clearer to people, you know, I know when I grew up, we're taught that the people who first sailed to America or who broke the ground in America were Christians, and there's a great deal of truth in that. But people are waking up to the fact that there was a Masonic force moving in things, and specifically Francis Bacon, for a bright guy like Benjamin Franklin, but also an occultist. When America was discovered, he wrote a book about America called The New Atlantis. And if you look back in your history of the Bible, the old world, this Luciferian world, the land of the giants and the demonic entities that were arise were wiped out by God in the flood. And he basically rebooted the planet. And I've got an article called Making Sense of the Supernatural on my website that goes into that whole history, including the extra-biblical books like the Book of Enoch. But the Freemasons and the secret societies rejoiced with this discovery of America because they realized that the old continent had not totally been wiped out. And they saw this as an opportunity to bring back a secular, and I will say monarch-free culture. But they knew they needed Christians to break the hard ground, and they knew they needed the government with their military forces to do that. But once they got established in the colonies, then their plan was to get rid of the colonial powers one by one. And, you know, first we'll get rid of the Spanish, and then we'll get rid of the French. And so the French and Indian War took place, right, expelling the French. And then it was to get rid of the British. And it's very interesting to me that as soon as the French and Indian War ended in 1763, and the American colonists and the British were allies in that effort, right? As soon as the French were out, immediately it flipped. The British flipped from good guys to bad guys. And we've seen this happen so often in our modern history. You know, Saddam Hussein, we supported him in the 1980s. Donald Rumsfeld was over there meeting with him. And then he became a bad guy, right, in the Gulf War of 91. And same thing, Osama bin Laden, we supported him and the freedom fighters in Afghanistan against the Russians in the 80s, and he became the bad guy, right? And Ho Chi Minh, the OSS, which became the CIA,
they
parachuted in to train Ho Chi Minh's troops and to arm them in 1945, and the Japanese didn't need to be beaten. That was to take out the French. Was with literally their purpose for being there. But then he became our enemy during the Vietnam War. And we've seen this happen so many times. I look at Russia during World War II, that the bad guys, I'm sorry, the good guys during World War II, and then they became the bad guys after World War II, and then the good guys during Gorbachev's era, now they're the bad guys. You know, they just keep flipping good guy to bad guy. And they did that with Britain, and the claim being made was that Britain was enslaving the American colonists with taxation. And I think we ought to take a little look at that because it kind of shows how lacking in substance the claims really were. You know, when I was growing up, it was never really explained to us why the British put a tax on the Americans. And the reason was this. They just fought the French and Indian War, which is a long war. And their debt had doubled. And since we were kind of the main beneficiaries of that war's victorious outcome, the British taxpayers felt they shouldn't bear the entire burden of paying it off. So they, in 1764, they had something called the Molasses Act, also called the Sugar Act, which put 3 cents on a gallon of molasses. And that was violently protested by Sam Adams and his Sons of Liberty. And so it was quickly repealed. And the British realized it was kind of a poor man's tax. And so they said, well, let's make a rich man's tax. And they came up with the Stamp Act, which had been very successful in Britain. They put a revenue stamp on things like business contracts and diplomas and newspapers. Well, the British never got one penny of revenue from that. And so they rescinded that because it was so violently protested in the colonies. And so I want to read to you kind of an interesting conversation between Parliament and Ben Franklin after these laws got rejected by the colonists.
Sure.
And because Ben Franklin was in Britain for a number of years as one of the American representatives, one of the, he would actually lobby Parliament on behalf of America. And so here's the first question from Parliament to Ben Franklin. I'm quoting, what was the temper of America towards Great Britain before the year 1763? Franklin's answer, the best of the world. They submitted willingly to the government of the crown and paid in their courts obedience to acts of Parliament. Question, did you ever hear the authority of Parliament to make laws for America question till lately? Benjamin Franklin's answer, the authority of Parliament was allowed to be valid in all laws, except such as should lay internal taxes. It was never disputed in laying duties to regulate commerce. Question, was an opinion in America before 1763 that the Parliament had no right to lay taxes and duties there? Franklin, I never heard an objection to the right of laying duties to regulate commerce, but a right to lay internal taxes was never supposed to be in Parliament as we are not represented there. Question, on what do you found your opinion that the people in America make any such distinction? Answer, I know that whenever the subject has occurred in conversations where I have been present, it has appeared to be the opinion of everyone that we should not be taxed by a Parliament wherein we are not represented. But the payment of duties laid by an act of Parliament as regulations of commerce was never disputed. End of quote from Benjamin Franklin in his exchange with Parliament. So you see Parliament in frustration asking Benjamin Franklin, what would Americans accept? And he said, well, we would accept you regulating your own commerce. So that resulted in Parliament passing the Townshend Acts, which placed a customs duty on various British imports to America. This was violently protested, again, by Sam Adams, the Sons of Liberty. And if you did business with Britain, your business would likely be torched or you'd broken into or some way dismantled. Although it's interesting that Sam Adams let his good personal friends like John Hancock carry on unfettered business
right.
with Britain. In fact, there's a newspaper in Boston called the Boston Chronicle, run by a guy named John Mine, who founded the first circulating library in Boston. And he printed a list showing all the business that John Hancock was doing with Britain. So he had his office ransacked. He was attacked on the street by 20 guys with clubs. And an order was given for his arrest, and he had to flee the city of Boston. So much for Sam Adams believing in freedom of the press. He actually personally participated in the search for John Mine. He couldn't get him. But Sam Adams only believed in freedom of the press if you agreed with his viewpoint. That is not freedom of the press. Freedom of the press, as we're now learning with all this YouTube censorship, means you have to be willing to tolerate someone else's point of view, which Sam Adams did not tolerate. But the point being that the custom duties were at the urging of Ben Franklin, who was, as we already seen earlier in the show, was the man who sent Thomas Paine over here to write Common Sense and the Declaration of Independence. Now, this would surprise a lot of people, but Parliament rescinded the Townshend Acts, and by 1773, which is 2 years before the Revolution began, there was only one tax remaining from Britain. It was the tea tax, by the Tea Act of 1773. And here's how that came about. They rescinded all the other customs duties, but it turned out that the British East India Company had a huge supply of tea in their warehouses, which was it was a surplus. It was going to rot if they didn't sell it. So they got together with the British government. Here's what they decided to do. They would offer it to colonists at half price, 50% off. That would save the British East India Company from, losing its tea. At the same time, they would tack on a 3 cent duty, customs duty on a pound of tea. That was it. And that was the only tax that King George or the Parliament was levying on American colonists by 1773, one single tax, a customs duty on a pound of tea of 3 cents. And that, of course, resulted in the Boston Tea Party, where the Sons of Liberty got liquored up, and they destroyed over 300 chests of tea. Now, imagine if that was the only tax we had to pay today. The King George III was not taxing your salary or your property. If you compare it to what we pay today, when we pay federal income tax, state income tax, if you've got a state that does that, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, real estate tax, sales tax, excise tax, utilities tax rate. If people today, I'll hear them say, well, I would have been joined the Boston Tea Party. Well, yeah, well, what about all these other, you know, that was nominal compared to the taxes we pay today. We're paying about half our income. That's one reason why you have to have both husband and wife and so many families working two jobs today. Like, taxation is outrageous. It's nothing compared to back then. This is, again, what I call the free pass theology, where, you know, we have one standard set for people today. And, you know, I've heard different pastors give sermons on taxation or mention taxation and look around the congregation and say, I hope you're all paying your taxes, not taking any breaks, you know.
Right.
You know, but if you ask those same pastors, and I've done this, what about the founding fathers? They say, well, no, they didn't have to pay taxes because they didn't have representation. Well, that's nonsense. When Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render to God what is God's, he didn't tell the Pharisees, you don't have to pay taxes to Rome because you don't have representation there. So if the founding fathers were truly Christian, they would have rendered unto Caesar that 3 cent minimal, 3 cent custom duty on tea, instead of going to war and causing bloodshed and the death of tens of thousands of people over it. I'm sorry, that's the only tax that remained by 1773. And we could actually go over the other grievances. We're not making ourselves particularly popular today. I know among, you know, this really is a cognitive dissonance thing. And, you know, I didn't learn about this in one broadcast or reading one book. So I realize for some people hearing this, it may be kind of shocking. Let me throw it back to you, Dan.
Well, then, following all of this history, then you had Andrew Jackson, which everybody thinks was this great hero, and he threw out the bankers, and that isn't true either. There's so much of what people accept in the so-called Patriot Movement that people accept, which is totally, absolutely not true if you look at the actual records. And the records do exist that clarify exactly who these people were serving, and they were serving themselves. And you talk about the taxes. There was the whiskey tax. And you also have to look at the ownership of land. The amount of land that George Washington owned. And just the whole scenario was pretty awful. And the people that were slaughtered, so that they could come in and take over the land. The people in the South, the native population in the South, who had to be marched out so that people from the North could come in and create big plantations. It wasn't the people who originally lived in the South, the regular independent farmers who lived in the South, who were the big plantation owners. It was the people from the North that came down and operated the big plantations. The small farmer often worked right alongside any of the African Americans that he happened to have. They worked alongside each other, and I don't believe in people owning other people, certainly, but you really have to look at history with a critical eye, because most of what we've been taught was designed by a group of individuals early on in 1900. Board of Education was paid for by certain people who wanted to portray world change history. If you want to alter your culture, all you have to do is alter your history or get rid of the artifacts. For instance, when the military goes into a country, whether you're talking about Iraq, whether you're talking about Afghanistan, whether you're talking about Libya, the first thing that they do is destroy the cultural artifacts. They take away people's culture and then replace it or attempt to replace it with things that the people would never have accepted before that. You bring in what, an American culture? What would that entail? Setting up houses of ill repute where soldiers could go in and rape the native people who live there? That's my rant for the day. Well, maybe I'll have another one, but.
Well, it's a good rant, and you're right. In fact, I've been told by Iraqis that one of the first things that the Americans soldiers did when coming into Iraq was to invade their back in the Natural History Museum and take out artifacts from there that belonged to their culture. And of course they confiscated the gold. They're after the natural resources as well that those countries have. So there's a whole slew of reasons that go into these wars that are always followed, you know, weapons of mass destruction didn't exist. There's always a false pretext for war. By the way, I did a talk in Watertown, Mass in April of this year, which it's been uploaded into SGT report and it's also on the welcome page of my website. It's called War and Deception. And Dan, what I do is I start with the Spanish-American War and I walk through every war up to the modern wars, showing that there was deception, not always an outright false flag, but there was always deliberate deception that got us into each of these wars. And again, because the mainstream media, which has been around for a long time, never told people the truth, you always had to consult the whistleblowers of the day, the people who published their alarms in small press books. But they were always there, whether the Spanish-American War, World War I, when Senator Robert La Follette spoke out, World War II, when you had people in the Navy Department who spoke out, but they couldn't get any attention from the press. You know, it's always been that way. Admiral James Stockdale, Tonkin Gulf, you know, there's always been people around who were not part of the plan, who spoke the truth, but never got the audience they deserved.
Right, and then you also have the plans to go in, oh, we'll go in and we will rebuild. We will offer these people, these countries, loans so that they can rebuild. And of course, nothing ever gets rebuilt. Those loans, that money, goes into people's pockets. The well-connected people get all this money, and nothing ever gets rebuilt.
Right. And those World Bank loans, of course, are paid for by taxpayers, and they get nothing back from it. But I mean, a few real wealthy people in those countries get all the money put into their private banks, and then the contract goes out to Halliburton or Bechtel,
right,
and they make billions off the rebuilding of the country that have been destroyed by bombs. So it's all part, of course, of an even larger agenda. They're multifaceted, these wars, but there are no good, humane, or Christian reasons for them.
Right. And actually, you could go back earlier to the Mexican-American War, 1846, the so-called Civil War, which was started by a false flag. Everything, you know, there's always this enemy that the Americans have to go after and take out. And it's just not, and it's all about money, it's all about power, and to the hands of corrupt people. Terrible.
Yeah, rich men's wars, they just, never end, but there's definitely continuity to it, and this is one thing I tried to stress in this PowerPoint presentation called War and Deception, that it's all leading towards this New World Order, the reshaping. You know, I was talking about Thomas Paine being an gun for hire anti-monarchist, whether it was in America, Britain, or France, and how the plan for the Freemasons was after this Spanish, French, and British governments had settled the Americas, was to kick out those governments and make America monarchy free. Now, let's
right.
Continue this at the other side.
Okay, we will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. Starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back. Our guest today for the first 2 hours is James Perloff, and we were talking about the changing of culture, and we referred to the changing here of our culture in this country. And so you really have to admit or to acknowledge that there definitely is warfare going on in our country. We're just not getting the bombs like the other countries that the military has invaded. Instead, we got people like Edward Bernays, who was very, very popular in the 1920s, and he promoted female smoking and all kinds of things. And so, yes, the culture of the entire world is changing, has changed, and it changes through different avenues according to where you live. We just don't have bombs going off. We have other things, but the culture has definitely been altered purposefully.
Yeah, we've gone a long way since that golden era that ended around what I consider to have ended in 63, with those events that we were just discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. I do believe this is probably the plan all along. We're talking about how enemies get flipped and how the British got flipped from good guy to bad guy overnight when the French and Indian War ended.
Right.
And the idea was to get, once these, the European monarchs had established colonies, that they would be, the monarchs and the countries would be kicked out and independent countries, would be formed over here. And I just want to talk about the Rothschild perspective on this. I mentioned that Thomas Paine hated monarchies, and he'd go wherever he went, he would try to overthrow the monarch of, contribute through his writing, the overthrow of the monarch of that particular country. And from the Rothschild perspective, they this goes back to the founding of the Illuminati with Adam Weishaupt, but they wanted to get rid of monarchs because the Rothschilds knew that as long as you had a hereditary monarchy, you couldn't marry into that bloodline unless you're particularly lucky that Rothschild was going to do that. So what you had to do is you had to get your Freemasons give them rallies and pep talks and promises and get them to overthrow the monarch for you in favor of democracy. Right. And the Rothschilds knew that under once the monarch was gone, that in a democracy, to get your man, the Rothschild representative, to run the government, all you need is 51% of the vote. And when you've bought up all the newspapers, you know that the Rothschilds own Reuters, of course, it's very simple to get 51% of the vote. Never mind election rigging, which also takes place. So from the Rothschild perspective, they wanted to get rid of the monarch so that they could take control and become their own elite royalty. Not to say that they haven't allowed a few monarchies like the current British one, which are loyal to them, to remain in place. But most of the monarchies today are figureheads, and they've been replaced by this whole Rothschild system. You go back to 1798, you had John Robison published a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy. We talked about the Illuminati. And he said their plan was to overthrow all the religions and governments of Europe. And that happened, you know. The cathedrals are empty now on Sunday. And all those monarchs from those days, the King of France, the King of Italy, the King of Belgium, where are they? They're all gone. They're all gone. There's another reason I should mention. I think we're coming up on another break very soon. But The Rothschilds hate Christianity, and you see that our current culture is becoming totally anti-Christian. And one of the traits, one of the trademarks of the old monarchs was that they were defenders of the faith, whether it was the Tsar in Russia or the Kaiser or the Austro-Hungarian Emperor or even the King of Britain. You know, in England, they had defender of the faith right on the back of their coins. The king was there. There was a unity between church and state and in the old days, and the king was expected to defend the church. Well, of course, the Rothschilds didn't want that. That's the other reason they wanted the monarchs to be thrown out. They wanted to create this secular world without religion, except, of course, a Luciferian.
Right. Indeed.
And you know, the overthrow of King George III. But when you come back on the other side of the break, we might talk a little about King George III.
All right.
Was he the tyrant that Thomas Paine said he was?
Exactly. Right. And as you say, they did have to, they did get rid of the monarchies, who actually cared about the people, and they've been painted, pictured as, you know, tyrants or whatever.
Yeah.
And certainly was, We have really been force-fed a false narrative as far as history is concerned. Absolutely, totally false. But, yeah, we're going to go to a quick break here. I don't hear the music.
Maybe they forgot.
Maybe they did. Sometimes
but
that happens.
Maybe Jeffrey Epstein's guard is
oh, my gosh. 20, okay. Yeah, maybe Epstein's guard.
Sorry about that. No, just kidding.
But, yeah, that's another thing. I totally believe that he was probably part of a honey trap kind of a situation, and I don't believe that he's dead. I really don't. Okay, we'll cut to a break. We'll be right back. All righty, we are back. And if you have a question, feel free to call us at 800-313-9443. And I believe we do have, did you want to finish making a closing remark, or should we go ahead and take John in Texas?
I think we're on a sort of a long segment here. I was going to talk a little about King George III, but we can go ahead and take a call because this is an audience participation
right.
show, and so why not? Yeah.
Okay, let's take John in Texas, and then we'll talk. Okay, go ahead, John.
I have a question about, have you ever read Hugh Bicino's paperback called A Rebel, or a small book, A Rebels in Red Coats, which is the companion book to the PBS TV series hosted by the British, what was it, British major, what Hugh Bicino contends is that the American Revolution was from the very beginning a French project. One of the reasons that the French gave away their agreed to give away the Canadian province of Quebec and kept the Sugar Island of Guadalupe because of it was to take away any threats to the British colonists, which would keep them loyal to the mother country. And they also, and then they started consorting with colonial dissidents. But is there?
Go ahead.
It was to create a continuation war with England to bring down Britain. Have you ever read that or heard of that? Heard that proposed?
I've not read the book called Rebels in Red Coats. I could believe that the French were probably stinging with resentment towards England after losing a war. And, you know, that's not an untypical way the psychology of a war would work. I did want to mention, though, that France was loaded with Freemasons. And I know that when Thomas Paine went over to France and asked, with a delegation to ask for money, the King of France was reluctant to give him that money, but the Freemasons, I have a book on this by a Freemason, people started marching in favor of America in the streets of Paris. When the King saw it, he thought, well, the people of France are in favor of America, so I'd best give them this money. Well, what he didn't know was that these marches were actually organized by the Freemasons. They were all Freemasons in these parades. I have a feeling, given the heavy presence of Freemasonry in France, and bearing in mind that Benjamin Franklin was not only the Grand Master of the Lodges of Pennsylvania, but the Grand Master of the Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris, that there's a Masonic connection running behind this French support of America. So I think they all tie together.
All right, so there's also another one about Benjamin Franklin.
Go ahead.
Do you know of his – was he a member of the – Lunar Society?
I don't recall that. I do remember he was a member of the Hellfire Club in Britain. which specifically took part in ceremonies that were lauding Satan or worshiping Satan. And that was not a commendable club, a very corrupt club with a lot of, sexual misdeeds taking place. We were talking about Jeffrey Epstein before. It's one that kind of brings that to mind. But I've not heard of his membership in the Lunar Club. Can you tell us what that was, John?
It was a sort of a convocation of people who were high up in literature and the sciences. Like one of the membership was Joseph Priestley.
Mm-hmm.
And what was another one? It was founded by Erasmus Darwin.
Oh.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and Darwin, of course, his descendant would, of course, go on to create the theory of evolution, which proposed that mankind was not created by God, but created by natural selection, and we evolved from lower life forms, which did a great deal to harm people's faith in God.
Right.
People not realizing it was the House of Cards. There were two books on it, Darwin's Theory of Evolution, so got to build around it in that.
But
yeah, it's just, you know, one thing I've never really explored, guys, that it's been clear to me, when you look at people like Benjamin Franklin and Francis Bacon, very smart people with a lot of advanced knowledge, there seems to be it seems that they're picking up some of this knowledge from their occult connections. I would have to say that. That there's definitely the Luciferianism that we see is integrated with this suggests to me that a lot of the people we kind of adore as being very smart and ahead of their time were smart, not just on their own, not to discredit any efforts that they put into their own education, but that they had connections that were telling them things that may basically came from, you know, spiritual forces, dark spiritual forces in this world.
Right. I agree. Okay, John, I appreciate your phone call.
All right, well,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care. All righty. I agree with you absolutely that they did have other sources of occult information. And there is always, what is the name of that? It just slipped my mind. I'll think of it later. But there's a practice of the occult. Oh gosh, what is the word I am attempting to think of? Secret information, secret combinations, secrets that the ordinary people do not understand, have not heard about, are certainly embraced by the so-called upper echelon governing powers that be. And they tend to think that they do tend to get away with a lot of things because of their affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their affiliation. And their education is different than the average person. And that's something else that is being taken out of the hands of people who used to be able to go to college very easily or relatively easily, now are indebted for the rest of their lives because college now costs so much money that the ordinary individual is incapable of going to college, or they will be paying for their college education, just a simple college education for the rest of their lives, while also trying to establish a business or have a life.
Yeah, it's insane, the student debt. And, you know, tuition at Harvard, you go back in time, 1962, was $1,520 for 1 year. And now, granted, we have inflation, but not at the extent that has taken place with the educational system. I really feel that the universities are in the hands of the bankers at this point. They're basically using students as pawns, get them into $100,000 or $200,000 of debt, and then they can't get a job when they're out, and they're basically the slaves of the system for the rest of their lives. Not that we were slaves before then, but it's been taken to a new level.
Right. And the other thing is that a lot of those, there are certain politicians that are saying, oh, we need to forgive student debt, the debt load for students, but it's the American taxpayer who's going to be paying off those debts.
Right.
So it's really, just, for the benefit of the bankers.
Absolutely, totally. Yeah, education has lost its meaning to college education. You know, people have said that, if you're going to spend, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 on college, it's better just to give your child that money and, let them start a business and, instead of, coming out of college with no job and all this debt. So,
absolutely
agree. Yeah.
Yeah. And, It is very unfortunate that people think that they actually have to have a college education and then they go out and can't get a job. They're flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. And people with real skills, people who can actually build something are really better off because you're actually producing something rather than, you know, doing something in the service industry.
Right, people with technical skills, that they acquire maybe in a tech school, instead of going to a normal, high school or a liberal arts college, people who have useful skills that are, don't cost that much money to acquire, hands-on skills, doing much better than, the average typical college grad with a business degree, for example.
Right. Right.
Well, I was going to take it around to what we started off on, which was the Masonic character of the founding of America. And I just wanted to recommend some resources for people. You know, the first tipping point for me before I started investigating what happened in Lexington, Mass., April 19, 1975, was a friend of mine who's red-pilled. It was a few years ago. Mentioned to me that these series of films by Chris Pinto that you can see on YouTube. It's called The Secret Founding of America. And, the best video to start with, these are 2 to 3 hours long, but they'll really, can red pill you on the Masonic nature of America's beginnings. The first one I would recommend watch is called Hidden Faith of the Founding Fathers. And there's another one on, you know, Francis Bacon and the original expeditions to America. And there's one on the occult Freemasonic architecture of Washington D.C. It's a very good series of films, which is, I think, a wake-up call that a lot of people now really need to have. Again, this is part of this idea of having the governments of Europe establish these colonies and then kicking out those governments to create a secular Western Hemisphere and then launch wars from this hemisphere to create the whole New World Order. That really seems to have been the plan. Almost recreating Atlantis, almost recreating this world that God had to wipe out before the flood. We were talking a little bit about Francis Bacon and Benjamin Franklin and their knowledge of principles that went beyond the average person and that possible connection to occultism. So I want to mention, if you go back to the Book of Enoch, which is referenced in the Bible, although it's not part of the Bible, it is actually part of the Ethiopian Bible. The Book of Enoch talks about fallen angels, which we in our movies and our culture call aliens, but it talks about how fallen angels, Lucifer's disciples came down to earth in the Book of Enoch and how they introduced new technology, metallurgy and other things that people have not known before. And I believe this all connects together at the end. I really believe that we're dealing with spiritual warfare and that this world government, this globalism that we keep hearing about, Council of Foreign Relations, is actually part of the fabric of all of that. And we see a TV show on television called Lucifer, and we see the Statue of Baphomet unveiled in
Detroit. Right.
And just this about a week ago, it was announced that there's a satanic culture in Canada, I forget the name of it, but they're going to hold the first black mass. It's a worshiping of Satan and a mockery of Christian Catholic mass, is going to be taking place. And so we really are opening this portal to the dark side, this Luciferian side. It is very real to me, the battle between God and good and with Satan and evil. It's definitely taking place. All these horrible cultural changes we've seen taking place in America since our golden age are part of it, and globalism is part of it, and destruction of nations is part of it. They set up a system where eventually there'll be one capital and one currency and an absolutist 1984 surveillance state, demonic in all its tendencies and character. 5G is part of it, right? So
right.
We're seeing this take shape, and you know, we're talking about today with Thomas Paine, the Declaration of Independence was just one step, a big step forward in the progression of that evil system, unfortunately. So we need to not only keep fighting it, and we do have some advantages in this battle, Deanna. One is that people get information today which they couldn't access before, and I never could have come to some of the conclusions I have without the internet. So as much as the internet is a source for evil and surveillance, and now censorship, it's been a great tool for learning things. The other thing is that we have God on our side because, you know, God is a God of truth, and we tell people, or seek to the best of our abilities to tell people the truth, unlike the mainstream media, which is doing the best it can to cover up the lies and to deceive the people so they'll accept Common Core and accept, you know, transgenderism and whatever the latest fruitcake Luciferian ideas that the deep state wants to push on the people of America and the people of the world.
Indeed. And it's amazing, too. You were talking about the unveiling of statues and things, how a lot of this is introduced through very popular activities like sports.
Mm-hmm, right.
The militarization of sports, which is, I don't watch sports, have no interest in them, but they start out to, well, uniforms and badges and singing of the, you know, the national anthem, and they use military phrases. So that is appealing to the gentlemen, the men in this country. And it's so sly, so subtle, and people just don't seem to get it. And it's so in your face. Oh my gosh. It's so in your face.
People have to climb out of the matrix to start to get it. If they're in the matrix, totally in the matrix, they won't see it, even though it is, like you say, it's in your face.
Right. Yeah. Really, really awful. Really awful. You did, you interviewed somebody about the 5G and, which I, you know, a lot of people are certainly worried about, and we do love our technology and, but it's, our technology, even though it has benefits and we all have benefited from it, it is also, pretty dangerous. Because of the radiation, the cell towers, the surveillance that we are experiencing on every level. There's a lot of people who are going out of Facebook, which I never really participated in. We'll be right back momentarily. Be right back. All right, we are back with James Perloff. And we were talking about Facebook and about some of the other things. And during the break, I was thinking also, I read an article recently about some of the big banks have gone in and taken over big retail stores, and purposefully have destroyed them. Sears and Penny's and a whole bunch of really large retail organizations that have employed a lot of people, and now we have a lot of unemployment. We also have the consolidation of, well, like Amazon and where you can buy just about anything. And so you have this big consolidation and more people out of work. It does not look good, but definitely get off Facebook and because it's nothing but you know, surveilling you, and people who write about their private lives on Facebook need their heads examined.
Well, of course, you know, in 1984, at the end of the movie, Winston Smith is taken to room 101, and right. They know what his greatest fear is. It's rats, and that's how they break him, by putting his face in a cage where they're trapped with rats. Well, how do they know what his greatest fear was? Because surveillance, right? So if people on Facebook say, oh, I just can't stand rats or something else, they'll know how to get to you, how they could get to you and break you like they broke Winston Smith in 1984. So you can see how much we parallel that book and how in 1984. Now, the more I've looked at it, the more I believe that 1984 was really speaking to reality. No question about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we've talked about a lot of very interesting things today, and including that document that so many in the Patriot Movement really have not researched to the depth that you have. And I really appreciate all of your work. It's fabulous. I respect it. And we've had some really wonderful talks together. I remember one time we did a special, and I didn't realize the recording device that I was using. It has where you could just choose to record one side. I didn't realize it's just in tiny, tiny little letters at the bottom that I was only recording what you had said and not what I had said. So, and you were really busy at the time, and so I had to go back and redub my side into it. But I learned to really look at the small print. And that's what you have done. You've looked at the small print. You've looked at the way things were written. You've looked at the writing styles, and you have presented a very, very interesting, well, the truth. I believe that this is what you have shared with us today is absolutely accurate, and I really appreciate it for the in-depth consideration that you've given this document and the first one that you wrote that was a preliminary, part one. Amazing work, and you were in the right place at the right time with the right set I don't know, just the right. You were a critical thinker. That's what you are. You're a critical thinker, and I appreciate that.
Well, so are you, Deanna, and the people who tune into your show. Thank you. I consider the world's greatest radio expert on World War II, and we've discussed that, and look forward to coming back on the show again.
Well, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye now.
See you, Deanna.
All right, we'll be right back. Stay with us.